guys, I'm a broken alcoholic. The echoing sound of that is really going to wig me out for a couple minutes. I'm sure I'll get over it. I don't know that I've ever been recorded in my entire life. This is a very new experience for me. I am extraordinarily nervous and full of fear, and if my voice starts shaking, that's really just self-centeredness leaving the body, I'm sure. It'll stop in a little bit, I imagine. When I was brand new, I heard somebody say something really interesting about fear. And they described it as being really, really, really tall. So tall you couldn't possibly even imagine climbing over it. When you looked side to side, it was so incredibly long that way and long that way, you couldn't walk around it. You know, there was just no way to get over this fear. And then they said, if you grab the hand of somebody in AA, you can walk right through it. It's paper thin. And I've experienced that before, and I know that the feeling I get when all of this is over and said and done, and I've spoke and I've said my piece, the relief that I get from that will be better than 1,000 drinks, you know. What a miracle. So I'm really grateful to be here. I must say that, if you can't already tell, public speaking is probably one of the least favorite things to do ever, I think, in my entire life. I think it's one of the worst things. But I'll tell you what one of the most rewarding things is, and that's getting to do something for Alcoholics Anonymous, because AA truly saved my life, and to be able to give back just a little bit, as uncomfortable as it might be for the first several minutes, you know, to be able to give back is truly a gift. So my sponsor, who's here with me, reminds me that when I'm asked to speak, it's just my turn, and it's really amazing that I get asked to do stuff like this. I gotta say, when I was young, when I was in my drinking, I didn't get asked to do a whole lot. You know, I wasn't trustworthy enough to be asked to do anything really. And I guess because I have so much time, not a whole lot, but enough. I'll give a little bit about my childhood. You know, I was raised in a broken home. I was diagnosed with a really rare bone disorder when I was very young, and my father wasn't around, and there was a lot of yelling, and there was a lot of fighting, and there was a whole lot of nonsense going on. And I tell you guys this not because that makes me alcoholic, because those things have nothing to do with my alcoholism, but man, did they make great excuses. And I became an excuse generator, you know, one thing after another. Oh, why? Well, here's this reason, this reason, this reason. And so when I started drinking at the ripe old age of 9, I certainly wasn't hitting the liquor stores. But I got a hold of a little bit of alcohol, and I tried it, and I liked it. And it made me feel older. It made me feel sort of, badass. You know, it made me feel good. And so I continued to do it. And even though I wasn't drinking every second of every day, it set me on the path to hang out with those people. And I sought out lower companions all throughout my drinking. I would continue seeking companionship that was lower than mine. So it made me feel a little better about myself. You know, I'm not quite as bad as those people, so I'm all right, you know. And I experienced a whole lot of consequences very, very early. You know, by the time I was 14, I was heavily involved in the court system. I already had one of those fancy little anklet bracelets, and that's after they had already tried house arrest and things like that. And I got sent to all of these different places. You know, my family really just loved me, and they didn't know what was going on with me, and I didn't really know either. I didn't have the words to describe it like they do in the big book. But all I knew was that I loved oblivion, and that I wanted to get there, and no matter what it cost, I would get there. And so I got sent to these short-term rehabs, long-term rehabs, ADS, ASAP, quiet rooms, you know, mental institutions. And the whole time, what I found there, what I thought I found there, I have a very sick, twisted perception on my life. So what I thought I was getting was a finger in the face. You need to stop drinking. You need to stop doing this. Why are you doing this? You know, all these questions. And I thought if you had to ask, then you surely wouldn't understand. And I really, what I found in AA was the language of the heart, you know. And it wasn't until I encountered that, somebody sitting down with me to say, hey, you know, this is what happened to me. This is the experience I had. This is what I did to overcome it. This is what worked for me. If you want it, come and get it. You know, it wasn't until I experienced that that I really found something that works. But in the rehab days, you know, it was just another day, another day, another day. And I did what I had to get out of those places and to continue drinking the way that I wanted. And so I did, and I managed somehow, there was a mix up with transcripts. I managed to graduate from high school, and I was at so many different places that they got it confused. And so I graduated from high school, and I thought, what I really need to fix me to really fix what's wrong inside is a good man, is a good job, and a place of my own. And so I went out. I set out to get those things. And of course, this was after a whole bunch of high school nonsense that I really just thought, you know, it's because I'm young. Why did I light off an illegal firework in the house, you know, and almost set the house on fire? Well, it's just because I'm young, you know. I'm just going through an experimental phase, these types of things. Little did my family know, or maybe they did know, I was wasted, you know. That's why I did stuff like that. Totally lost my train of thought. So I set out to go get the guy, get the job, get the place, you know, and I found a really great guy. He was actually a really good guy, and unfortunately he fell under the most severe consequences of my drinking, I think. He and I found a nice little apartment, and I was unstoppable. There was just no... I would go to work. I would show up for that, and I couldn't go more than a couple hours without getting wasted somehow, some way. So I developed a nice pill addiction to keep me going during the day, so that when I got off, I could drink whatever I wanted. You know, whether it was tequila, whether it was wine. I bring a meeting into the detox, and I hear a whole lot of talking about, well, my drug of choice. You know, and I always laugh because my drug of choice was more of whatever you had, preferably for free. You know, it was just, it was always more. And so it didn't matter if it was the pills or the alcohol. Like, I just needed to do something to get me through the day. And my boyfriend at the time would come home after working a long, hard day. He was a mechanic. He worked really hard. And he would come home to find me with blue lips, not breathing, passed out of my own food. You know, stuff like that was happening, and I didn't really think twice about it. You know, it was just it was just a part of the way that I was living, and he was scared and he was worried, and so that happened for a number of years that I would live like that. That I would go to the chronic pain management specialist, and oh, my bones, you know, because I had that great excuse, I have this bone disorder, it hurts so bad. Give me more pills, you know, and I'd get these pills, and then I'd go to the liquor store and I'd get a couple of bottles of tequila or rum or whatever was plastic so that I could afford it, and I would just go to town every single day. That's how I lived. And finally I lost the job, you know, and slowly but surely I was losing the guy too. And before I had the opportunity for that to happen, I took a trip down to Haiti. And what's interesting about this trip down to Haiti is that I knew my life was coming to sort of a breaking point. I knew that at the very least I was broken. I couldn't stop drinking. I couldn't stop getting wasted. I didn't know what to do. And I feel like intuitively somehow I knew that I needed to help somebody else, which is hilarious because I was not capable of helping another human being at that time. And so I had the opportunity to go down to Haiti and to work at some orphanages there for a couple of weeks through my mom's church. She works for a church. And so this idea of helping people, that was truly going to save me. And so I went down to Haiti, and what I found down there was me all over again, you know. And there I was on this compound snorting Xanax and drinking tequila all over again, and then going to play with little children from orphanages, you know. And so when I got back, something happened, and I snapped, and I left my life behind. You know, the guy was getting a little too protective over me. He wanted me to stop. He wanted me to get help. My mom was starting to close in and tell me that I needed help. You know, all of these people could see what I had felt all along, and that was that I was dying. You know, the only difference between them and me was that I didn't really care. I just wanted to continue on because that's all I knew. That's what felt good. That's what felt right. And even though I was dying, it didn't really make any difference. So I left the guy. And I abandoned my life, my things, my cat, my clothes, all of my belongings, his family, my family. I left it all behind to go couch hopping and run away with his best friend. You know, because that's the kind of ideas that I have. That's the way that I treat people. You're not doing it for me, so I'm gonna go over here. You know, and it's just it's a sad, unfortunate thing that that's how I live my life. But that's the truth of it. You know. And so I found myself doing incredibly insane things, like it says in the book, insane, incredibly tragic things, however it's worded. One of those incredibly tragic things that I ended up doing was I had a running buddy while I was drinking, and she was one of my only friends left because I destroyed relationships so quick. People didn't invite me back. There was no, like, happy partying at this point, you know. But her and I were running a couple of games at some local hospitals, and so we were sitting out in front of this one hospital in particular trying to figure out how we were going to go in and get what we thought we needed to be okay to mix with the alcohol. And we couldn't think of anything, you know, so I asked her if she had a hammer, and she did. She just so happened to keep a hammer in her glove box. Go figure. And I took said hammer, and I beat my kneecap in, and I had her help me hobble into the hospital and get what we thought we needed, you know. And that story, I think the worst part of that story is that I didn't remember it until several months into sobriety, when the same woman who I smashed my kneecap in with told me about it, because she ended up getting sober too. And it was like this whole full circle thing where she said, "Remember that thing you did?" And I looked at her with horror. "Are you serious?" You know. And then, of course, the memory bubbles came back, and I remembered all of the details of that horrendous thing that I did, you know. But that's a great illustration of what I'm willing to do to get what I think I need, you know. And if it seems like a good idea in the moment, I'm probably going to do it. And if that means stealing from you or from my family or from a stranger, if it doesn't matter what I have to do to get wasted, I'm going to do it, you know. So I finally wound up at I guess a lot of people call them crack houses. It was just a drug house. I mean, it was one of those lowly places where there was mold growing on the ceilings and the walls, and you surely didn't want to walk around barefoot there, and I was living there. And again, I had found myself around lower companions, or so I thought. And these people wouldn't tell me that my drinking was outlandish. You know, these people wouldn't tell me that I needed to stop. And my plan was really just to drink myself to death there. And so I started out strong, and I did that. And they set up an intervention for me. And they did it in the classic way where they wrote notes and they sat in a circle and they read me these heartfelt letters about how I was dying and how I was killing myself. And I thought, you've got to be kidding me, man. You know, these people, of all people, are telling me that I need to get help, you know. And it was a turning point in my drinking. It was probably one of the best things that could have ever happened for me. Because in that moment, I knew that I had gone beyond human aid. I knew that that I wasn't really going to be able to pull myself up by my bootstraps, like people say, and get well, you know. So I went ahead and I called Mom, you know. I said, "Mom, I've gotten really sick. I've gone too far. You know, will you meet with me for coffee?" And it had been a good 9 months to a year that I had let my mom wonder. And she's told me now since I'm sober, that she would spend nights wondering when she was going to get that phone call, you know, when are they going to call me and tell me my daughter's dead? And a lot of people were surprised she didn't get that phone call, you know. Instead it was me calling, desperate for help, you know. And she did. She met me for coffee, and she looked me up and down, and she said, "Where's the rest of my daughter?" And she had tears in her eyes. And And so I said, Mom, I need to come live back at home with you. And she said, hell no. Good old mom, you know. Thankfully, she wasn't the owner of the house. So I went above her head and I asked my great-grandfather. And he said, come on back. You just got to be sober, you know. And I thought, all right, I'll do it, you know. I'll get sober. I'll do this thing. Unfortunately, that didn't happen, you know. I still had a lot of experiences to have, and even though I made resolutions to myself every time. And looking back on it, I'm glad that I have those experiences, because when I started reading through the book and it talks about no human power, and really discovering the powerlessness, that being able to look back on the powerlessness that I felt, I think the greatest example that I have to illustrate my powerlessness was getting arrested and sent to the drunk tank, which was not a humongous deal. It was just this time in particular, I had blacked out and I woke up in the drunk tank and I did the limb check. And I actually didn't mind blacking out a whole lot, because it was sort of like time traveling, and I would just wake up in these different places. If I didn't remember it, it didn't really happen, you know, and so it didn't really matter how I had conducted myself the night before. And if somebody tried to tell me, I could just cover my ears, la, 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 I can't hear you, you know, probably didn't act like that. And so I woke up in the drunk tank and I did the limb check, and things hurt, my whole body hurt, you know, and I opened my eyes and I knew that bench, and I knew I was in the drunk tank, and I look over and I see these two girls huddled as far away from me as they could possibly be in the drunk tank, just looking at me like, oh my God, she's awake, you know? And I looked down, and I was covered in blood, and I didn't know if it was mine or somebody else's, you know? Had no idea. In that moment, I thought that I had killed somebody and that I was going to spend the rest of my life in jail. I found out later, I didn't kill anybody. I had hurt myself very badly, and so all of the blood was my own, thank God. But it was in that moment that I said, no more. This is it. This has gone too far. This is really bad. I need help. I'm not going to drink tonight. And I said it with such sincerity. I was so convinced. I knew down to my core that I could not drink. And I got out of the drunk tank, and somebody picked me up, and a couple hours later, there I was again. Almost how they describe in the book, banging on the bar, how did it happen again, except I didn't do a whole lot of bar drinking. Every time I went to a bar, the tab would be well over $100, because I, surprisingly enough, I wasn't the type to go hit up a bunch of people for free drinks or whatever, you know, so I would go and I would pay for it myself, and it would be over $100, and I would think, why didn't I just get the plastic, you know, I could get so much more wasted for the money. So anyway, I eventually hit this point of desperation where it's like the jumping off place, you know, where I couldn't picture my life drinking, and I couldn't picture it sober, and I just couldn't picture it, you know, and it is just too painful. And so I made a deal with the God that I was very angry with, or that I didn't believe in, or whatever. I had a lot of feelings and thoughts and beliefs about this God. But I said a prayer. I'm sorry, scratch that. I didn't say a prayer. I made a deal, because that's how big and powerful I am to be able to make a deal with an ever-loving creator. So I made this deal with God, and it was that I was going to make one phone call to somebody who I knew was sober. And it was that woman who I smashed my kneecap in with. She had gotten sober, and I had heard about it through the grapevine, and she disappeared, you know, and so I was going to make this one phone call, and if she picked up, I'd give AA a try, you know, and if she didn't, I was going to kill myself. And I made the phone call. She didn't pick up. It went to voicemail. And so I started making arrangements, you know, and she called back. And there she was, probably 2 hours later. She came and picked me up for a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there I found really, really happy, shiny, smiley, freakish people. Just really bizarre, you know, because I just... I wasn't hanging out with the type of people who were smiling and asking me to come back anywhere. You know, I was a part of the partying lifestyle. I had embedded myself into that, and even though I wasn't attending parties anymore and drinking with my pinky up, you know, I was definitely in dingy old basements and very occasionally on rooftops, you know, getting wasted. And so this change of scenery was very strange to me. But she picked me up and took me, and I smelled, and I was completely incapable of doing anything to take care of myself. You know, I don't know if I had brushed my teeth or taken a shower, but I was really nasty, and I was a hot mess, and every time I opened my mouth, crazy would come out. And it didn't matter, you know, it didn't matter. And because I had known her from drinking and doing drugs, seeing her sober had such an incredible impact on me. You know, here stood a woman, not just some wasted chick, you know, a woman who held herself with dignity and respect, and she had her head held high, and she was shiny, and her skin was clear, and she smiled at me. She said, "It's so good to see you," you know, and gave me a hug, and then took me to that meeting. And I don't remember too much from my first meeting as far as what they said, but I remember that I was starting to hallucinate because it had been so long since I had slept, and there was, it was a speaker's meeting, and behind was this big red curtain thing, and it started like doing the wave, you know, and so I focused in a whole lot on that and not as much the words of the meeting, but I gathered that these people were very happy and that they were living in a completely different way than I had been living, and that was attractive to me. And so they asked for my number many, many times. You know, it was like I was attacked after the meeting. And I sort of had that feeling like, how do they know I'm new? It's very, very obvious. I know now, you know, when I see a new person come, hey, that's my girl over there, you know, stumbling in. So they knew I was new, and they asked me for my number, and they asked me what I was doing the next day, and they asked me if I had a sponsor. And they asked me so many times if I had a sponsor that I got a sponsor. And I'm so glad I did, you know, because I had no interest in getting to know another woman on a level that I've gotten to know another woman. You know, just I keep thinking about that part in the book, Who Wishes to Be Rigorously Honest. You know, and it goes through that list of really awful things. Why would we want to do this, you know, unless our lives depend on it? And surely my life depended on it, you know. And so I asked the woman who I smashed my kneecap in with to be my sponsor, because that made sense to me at the time. And it didn't end up working out exactly in the future as I, you know, started to really work through the steps. I had a hard time listening to what she said because I would just see her and think, like, we used to pass out on our food together. Why are you telling me what to do right now? You know. So I ended up getting another sponsor, but the important thing is that I started going through the book. We sat down and we started reading. And I was really embarrassed about my reading skills when I got sober. I had a really hard time reading. I had a really hard time retaining anything. I would read a sentence and then read another sentence, and then everything for the last like 15 minutes before that was gone, you know, just gone. And I would stumble on my words. And it's like the letters would get all mixed up. Anyway, my reading comprehension, it was very bad. And I thought that made me less of a person. I thought it was something to be really embarrassed about. And it was just another reason why you guys wouldn't accept me. You know, I kept looking for all of these reasons why I was different, why I didn't fit in, why I wasn't quite right where I was, you know. Another way that I did that was when we were going through the book. We open it up, and first thing I read is doctor's opinion. And I wanted to throw the book out the window of the car because I thought, you got to be another doctor's opinion. Is that really what I need right now? I am dying here, and you're telling me to read about a doctor's opinion? And so it made me really mad, and so I just sort of tuned it out, you know. And we got to, there's a solution, and I felt like, well, you know, damn it, if there's a solution, why do I feel so screwed? Why do I feel like this isn't going to work for me? Why do I feel like I cannot escape this misery that I'm feeling right now? You know, and I'm so glad I kept coming back until we read Jaywalker, And there I found myself. There I was. And it was that moment that I've seen so many women have, because I've gotten to the place in my sobriety where I'm able to take women through the book and I'm able to sit with them and watch those lights turn on. And it happened for me when we read Jay Walker. I said, oh my God, that's me. And I'll tell you the reason why I related so much was because when I was really young and really dumb, I would get wasted at the skating rink and play a game with my friend. And I don't even remember the name to the game. It was just really dumb. But we would run out into the middle of the road, lay down, and see who would get up and run away first with cars coming at me, you know. And so Jay Walker about summed it up, you know. I'd call that pretty extreme jaywalking there. Another thing that I really struggled with when I first got sober was honesty. I didn't know how to be honest. I didn't even know how to cook eggs, you know. True story. I had to learn how to cook. But honesty was just one of those things that wasn't very highly valued amongst the people who I was hanging out with. You know, chances are if you were like, I honestly have to tell you guys I'm feeling really, you know, sensitive right now, you were going to get taken advantage of one way or another. So this hard shell on the outside, I'm fine, you know, type thing was sort of hard to crack in me. And so the honesty thing was of the learning variety, just like my spiritual experience. I had to learn the hard way for some things because I am an individual of extremes. And so I went from not being honest at all to being overly borderline mean. Okay, definitely mean honest. You know, one of the greatest examples I have of that is when I was living with my grandmother. My grandmother is very sick. She has bipolar. She says that Jesus has healed her, so she doesn't need medication. I politely disagree. She was cooking, and she cooked this food, and I'm sure she tried very hard, and the food came to me, and I tasted it, and I said, your cooking is horrible. I don't think I'll ever eat it again. And I shoved it away, you know. And I go to my sponsor, and I'm like, I don't know why she's so angry. I was being honest. This is something that you guys are teaching me here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't you guys love honesty? Like, I'm just being honest. And that's not what honesty is, you know. What I did was hurtful. It was mean, and it was wrong, you know. But I wouldn't have known that if I didn't have a sponsor and if I didn't have people in AA who I could be honest with. And so I told them this story, and they told me to never do that again, you know. And to go make amends. To go say that I was sorry, and to not only say that I was sorry, but to follow that up with opposite action. To really show somebody that I was sorry with my actions was a totally new concept. I was really great. I mean, along with the excuses that I would generate, it would be like I'd hand out I'm sorry's like money. You know, it doesn't matter. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. And I would never follow it up with any action that represented me truly being sorry or having a change of heart. So I started working through the steps, and when I looked at step one, it was pretty easy for me to see that my life was unmanageable and that I was completely powerless. You know, I started having memory bubbles about my alcoholism and my drinking, and I started learning things about myself that were just undeniably powerless and unmanageable. You know, if I put a drink up to my face, I could not guarantee that I would stop. I didn't know if I would stop, when I would stop, what would stop me. You know, was it going to be jail? Was it going to be a family member? Was it going to be somebody restraining me? You know, I just didn't, I don't know. And so I feel like I always had some version of a first step. It was another great excuse, you know, why do you do the things you do? Well, I'm an alcoholic. And when I went to that rehab, I went to a long-term rehab that was for a year and 5 days. And while I was there, you know, I really learned about alcoholism, you know, and it became this really great excuse. But really, to get a first step, I had to take action. You know, I've really come to understand AA to be a lot about action for me, because I can talk a really good program. I can use the lingo, you know, I can pick up on stuff like that pretty quickly, But it's the action, man. It's the action that leads me to become a new person. And that's what I needed. I needed to be a new person. And so I struggle a lot with God. A lot. When I got to step two, really just when I walked in the doors and I heard the word God even used lightly, I would get so enraged that I would feel like throwing chairs at people. I didn't want to hear it. I didn't want what those people had. You know, even though I'm desperate and dying and I have no other solutions, you guys talk about God and I'm like, I don't think I want what you guys have. I'm so glad I didn't let that destroy my chance that I had here. And the reason why was because I reached a point of desperation in sobriety. I heard that a lot when I was new, the gift of desperation, and I thought that was pretty silly because a gift is something expensive that you buy for somebody, you give them this gift, you know, that is a gift. And what I learned about this gift of desperation was that I had it, and that it was actually a really expensive gift, and I paid for it out of my moral fiber, you know, just gave it away to get that gift of desperation. And a lot of us, you know, pay with our lives and don't ever make it back, or don't ever make it here to the point where we are today sitting in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. So I feel really grateful that that I finally reached that point of desperation sober. And what I found was that the problem the whole time hadn't been the drugs or the alcohol. You know, the problem was me. And the solution to the problem that was me was continuing to work through the steps, despite how I felt about this God thing. And so the more I struggled with the God concept, the faster I was moved through the steps. And I would say things like, I don't understand this. I do not have a God. I haven't worked step two. I haven't worked step three. I don't know what you guys are talking about. Keep moving on, you know. And thank God my sponsor said it's okay. Let's keep moving on. Let's do a four step. Get it done. You know, we said the third step prayer. And I don't really think that I said it with any belief that anything would happen. You know, I said it half-heartedly under my breath. And I moved on to the four step. And when I wrote the four step, all this while I had experienced some relapses. You know, relapsing certainly doesn't have to be a part of anybody's story, but it's definitely a part of mine. And the reason why I continued to relapse was because I was still holding on to old ideas. Like it says, you know, or like I was told, you hold on to old ideas, you do things the old way, you're going to get what you've gotten. And in order to get something new, you got to do what we're doing, which is something new. It's like, you know, very logical, but it wasn't to me at the time. So the last relapse that I had was over some painkillers. You know, I went to the hospital. I dislocated my ankle. I thought I got this. You know, I was like 3 months, 4 months sober. I brought a newcomer with me to the doctor because she's going to keep me sober, you know. And the doctor said, yeah, okay, so you're in pain, you know, do you want this or this? And I said, no, I'm sober. Can't have anything that'll mess me up. And he goes, okay, yeah, sure. Well, so do you want a shot of Dilaudid or this other pill? And I was like, oh my God, is that even a question? You know, and then I had it when I didn't need it. And I was off to the races again, you know, for a week. And that was the place that that I decided I was going to be all in. And I was guaranteed that if this didn't work for me, my misery would be refunded. And I was grateful for that, you know. And I clung to the idea that if this didn't work, I could always go back to the way things were. And I made it through that fourth step, you know. And I wrote down, as honestly as I possibly could, every single resentment that I had. And it was really difficult, you know. And it took me 3.5 months and like 2 hours. Because I sat on it, and I just sat on it, and I kept sitting on it. And then I had a nightmare that I died if I didn't do it. And I got up and I did it, you know, in a matter of a couple hours. And I went over that four step with my sponsor, and we continued moving on, you know, and we reached more God steps. Ugh. And yet again, I said, I don't believe in God. I don't get it. I don't have a higher power. I don't know what you guys are talking about. And she said, that's okay. Let's keep moving on. And the reason why I believe she said that was because when I finally did make it to the 12th step, I had a relationship with a higher power. It happened behind my back, against my will. You know, I had developed some sort of relationship with the loving creator. And I don't really, I can't define it. You know, I don't know what it's called. I don't know what it looks like. I don't know too much about it. I just know that when I look back through my drinking, there were too many times where I should have been dead that I wasn't. And I knew that there was some sort of greater purpose for me here than there was in the bottle. And so I found that. And I think that what that is and what that looks like for me today is helping people. And so I started to cultivate a life with the hands of the people in AA that looked a whole lot like helping people. I learned how to be a student in AA, and so I got the opportunity to go back to school and to really give it my all. You know, I had never been a good student of any kind. I mean, if I attended school at all, I didn't remember it, you know. So here I was going to college again, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. And at the time, I was living with my great-grandfather, and I had the ability to make amends to him. I sat him down, and I said, you know, this is what I did. This is how I was living. These are the ways that I harmed you. How can I make it right? And he said, I want you to go to school. I want you to get an associate's degree. And I didn't know what that was going to look like, you know, because here I am just taking random classes. I didn't know what I wanted to be. I didn't know what I was doing. I had no idea what God had planned out for me. And so I kept going to school, and I ended up becoming a paramedic, and I graduated with honors, and he watched me from the stands, and he cried because he was so happy to see me walk across with the cords and everything, you know. And it was a huge deal for my family because it was a turning point for them. Like, wow, this is really the new person who's up there on that stage, you know. And so they got to witness all of these interesting changes take place in my life, and really me transform from this horrible zombie puddle of yuck to this woman who stands before you today, you know? And I get to be that woman, like the first woman who stuck her hand out to me, where I get to hold my head up high, and I get to be a woman with dignity who doesn't act in the ways that I was acting when I was drinking, you know? So I feel like I've been talking for like 6 hours. I have like no concept of time. I told you guys my perception is off, right? So this is an example of how my perception is off. I'm going to read my favorite part of the big book. How about that? Let's do that. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could, and the other to accept spiritual help. That's not an easy choice, man. It's not. I really, when I read that in the big book and I got the hairs rose on my arms, you know, I thought, man, what a choice. And throughout my sobriety, even still today, the spiritual help is sort of difficult, you know. I have a really hard time asking for help. I really do. And it's amazing how quickly the ego rebuilds itself. And as I stand tall, you know, I somehow forget what brought me to that place, you know, and that it's not me who's done all of this amazing stuff, you know, but me who's really sat on the shoulders of people in AA, and they've, you know, done a whole lot of the work. Sometimes it was heavy dragging because I was not trying to go along with what they were saying, you know. Oh, I just keep running into a wall of, like, what do I talk about now? Sponsor to the rescue. See, man, sponsorship is awesome. That's another thing I could talk about. One of the most amazing gifts that I've gotten in AA has been the ability to sponsor other women. I was talking about helping people and I went off on a tangent. So the helping people is one of the greatest rewards that I have, and one of the ways that I help people is through sponsorship. And I've actually gotten to the place now, just recently, where my sponsee is now sponsoring women. And so she's coming to me saying, like, oh, my God, I don't know what to do. You know, how do I work somebody through the fourth step? Like, how do I hear a fifth step? What do I say? What do I do? And it's just such a neat feeling to have the answer to that. You know, what you do, you listen. What do you share? Your experience. What do? Tell the truth. That's what she told me. I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm so nervous. She was like, just tell the truth, man. So true, you know. And so I get to watch these other women start to walk in sobriety and get their sea legs or whatever. That is a neat experience that I had. When I first got sober, I didn't know how to have fun. I thought that I should punish myself, you know, because I had plenty of fun and the fun was over and I needed to get down to business. And that meant being really serious and being sort of sad. And I was so sad. I was so sad, in fact, that I got the nickname of Muir. Hey, guys. How's it going? It was terrible, you know, and the people of AA loved me through that, and they would invite me to things, you know, like the diner and bowling and all of these weird things that I thought, you know, how am I going bowling on a Friday? How is that even happening right now? I'm sitting at the diner drinking coffee with these weirdos, you know, but in my heart I knew that it was so much better than what I was doing before. And it's almost like I was mourning the loss of my best friend, you know, because alcohol was really the closest to my heart, closer than my family, closer than my best friend, closer than my dog, everybody, you know, it was really. And so taking that away did make me very sad. And I didn't think life was ever going to be the same. And I didn't think that I could have fun or that I could allow myself to have fun. And so I got taken on a beach trip. I thought that was a horrible idea. Why are you going to take me to Ocean City? You know, I used to spend time on the beach drinking grain alcohol and then going out into the water nearly drowning and thinking, like, wow, that was a really great day. And here I am with these sober AA folk, and they want to chain smoke cigarettes and drink energy drinks all the way down to the beach. And so I went with them. I didn't really have anything else going on. I was quite the loser. So I went with them. And what I found on that trip was a pain in my face so great from laughing and from smiling. It was the first time that I had ever experienced something like that, where I literally felt the pain in my face and I was like, oh my gosh, something's wrong. What's wrong? What's happening? What's happening? And somebody pointed out, it's because you've been smiling and laughing. And while I was smiling and laughing and having this great time, I wasn't thinking about drinking. And I thought that was just amazing, you know, because there I was at the beach in these old stomping grounds that I had gone to before. Surely I wouldn't be able to go but 5 minutes without thinking about alcohol. But there I was, you know, laughing and having a good time. And so little things like that started happening that kept me coming back. It kept me coming back. For a while, I thought, I got the singleness of purpose a little confused. I thought that that meant that I could tell my family to screw off, you know, I'm doing the AA thing. I got a singleness of purpose. That's how I'm staying sober. It's a big deal. You know, you can do your own dishes after dinner. I'm going to go to the AA meeting. And that was wrong. It was quite wrong. And I learned how to show up and be a family member and to help my family. You know, and I only learned how to do that through helping other people in AA, through making coffee, picking up cigarette butts. You know, those were the same ways that I was learning how to be a student and the same ways that I was learning how to be a family member, how to show up, how to keep my mouth shut, and how to just do some dishes. Man, I can't tell you guys how many times that saved me at awkward family events. You know, where are the dishes? I'm going to go do some dishes, you know? And I know that well now. And I know how that starts to feel when I want to open my big fat mouth and say something that I shouldn't say, you know, and instead I look for a way to be helpful. And I look for a way to give to the situation rather than take away. And that's a huge deal, you know, because my selfishness was just so overwhelming when I was out there drinking. Everything was about me. I couldn't think beyond my nose. It was just all about how was Brooke going to get wasted. And to get sober and to actually have that thought of like, I wonder how my mom's doing. I'm going to go ahead and give her a call. You know, I'm going to bring her flowers at work. It's not Mother's Day, but I'm just going to do that, you know, to be able to do those things and to not look for something immediately in return. Because that was another thing. I thought that I knew how to be a giving person and how to give freely of myself. But I was always just looking for something in return. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about my job being placed in a position to be of maximum usefulness to God and my fellows. Boom. There it is. Right there. Big book coming true all up in my life. You know, and now I get the opportunity every time I'm at work to help people who are in some of the worst moments of their entire life, you know, to smile at them when I feel like I'm so exhausted that I couldn't possibly, like, move another facial muscle, to put my hand out and to really just be in the moment. And that's another truly incredible thing, is to be able to just be in the moment, you know. I'm going to talk, I don't have a whole lot of time left, and so I'm going to talk about what I've been screwing up on, because I don't want to talk about what I've been screwing up on. So what better time to talk about it, you know? Admit to a whole entire room of fellow alcoholics what I haven't been doing. I have an amends to make, and I don't want to do it. I found that I am not, I'm really selfish with money. There, I said it, just throw it out there. I am so incredibly selfish with money that I don't want to pay a $500 amends. That's it. That's what's stopping me from regaining, like, sunlight of the spirit status, you know, walking hand in hand with the creator of the universe, whatever. Not trying to do it, you know. I reach these little points in my sobriety where it's like I regress to being a child and I want to throw myself on the ground and bang my hands and my feet and say, I don't want to. It's $500. It's my $500, you know. And so what I can tell you guys is that doesn't feel very good, because I know right from wrong now. I can't hide behind this illusion of I'm wasted. I don't know what's going on. You know, I'm 100% sober standing before you, and I know that something's not right within me because I haven't done this thing. And the consequences are pretty light at first, you know, and then it starts moving a little more towards crazy town, and I start thinking a little bit more about a drink. I hover a little longer around the wine and the 40s and stuff at 7-Eleven. And that is truly a danger zone for me. I'll tell you what is pretty cool is that I notice it and I talk about it and I'm able to say it in front of a group of people. And what that means for me is that the amends is going to get paid. I'm just being a baby about it right now, you know. I might even leave this meeting and go pay it because my sponsor is hearing me say all of this right now. We might be making a little bit of a stop, you know, after we're done here. And thank God. Because if that is truly what stands in between me and being happy and sober, you know, I don't want to let that destroy what I have. And what I have is a truly incredible life. I really do. All of the outside circumstances have gotten a lot better. I don't have a car with mysterious dents all over it. You know, I don't wake up in the drunk tank anymore. I don't find myself going to the grocery store at 5:45 in the morning with a bag of pennies, waiting for them to start selling alcohol so that I can buy some 40s with said pennies. You know, that shame and that guilt and all of that, I don't feel that anymore. And I have a little bit of money in the bank account, and I have clothes that don't have cigarette burns or liquor stains all over them, and these things are really great. But one of the absolute best things that I have today is the ability to meet my own eyes in the mirror. And that was huge. That was huge for me to actually be able to look at myself in the mirror and know that I'm the best person right now, today, that I can possibly be. That I don't harm other people intentionally, that I don't live my life in a way where it's all about me. And also, this is sort of silly, but I never thought the shaking would stop. And as much as people told me, you know, it'll stop, I think it's interesting how we hand, like, newcomers coffee. You know, I was already shaky, and then somebody would put coffee in my hands, and then I would be shaky, and all the coffee would be all over myself, you know. I can grab a glass with one hand and put it up to my face and drink it, you know. Amazing. And so when I go to the detoxes and I bring meetings in there, I reassure them that they too can have this thing. And some of them wonder, why are you doing this? You know, if you have more than 4 years sober, why are you bringing a meeting in here? Why are you still going to meetings? Why are you doing this stuff? And I tell them, because in order to keep it, I have to give it away. And I'm so glad, you know, that I can tell my story and be in contact with the girl who walked in here. Because I never want to be too far away from that girl. I want to remember the pain. I want to remember why I'm here and why I'm doing these things, why I'm paying an amends, you know. And it really, it all started with me just saying, okay. And I think that's the most spiritual I get on a day-to-day basis, is I just say okay to what Alcoholics Anonymous asks me to do. And amazing things have happened, you know. So for that, I am really grateful. Thanks for letting me share. Thank you.